This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
Good evening. Thank you so much for joining us for what I know is going to be a very, very, very special evening. And thanks so much to the Lannan Foundation for their forethought in inviting Ta-Nehisi Coates to join us this evening. And what a time to be having this conversation. I know that you all watch the news and perhaps listen to the news. And so you know it is indeed fortuitous that he is here with us this evening. I'm Michelle Norris. And after Ta-Nehisi speaks this evening, thank you, I'll have a chance to ask him a few questions and dive a little bit deeper into his work and how he does his work and who he is as a man. And before he begins, let me tell you just a little bit about who he is as a man. And forgive me, as I get older, I have to carry devices with me to help me remember things instead of pieces of paper. Ta-Nehisi Coates is a writer, a journalist, an educator. He is a student and a professor. He's an oracle. He's a sage, he's a seer, and a compass at a very important moment in American history. He is a treasure, and we are so fortunate to be able to spend this evening with him tonight. He also has some official titles. He's a senior editor for The Atlantic, where he writes about culture, politics, and social issues. He's a former writer for The Village Voice and The Washington City Paper. He's been a contributor to Time Magazine, to O Magazine, to The New York Times Magazine. He's contributed to both The New York Times and The Washington Post newspapers. He's a prolific voice in social media, where he shares his insights, where he instigates debate, spars with people who use the forum to speak in a matter that recalls the James Brown song, Talking Loud and Saying Nothing. Ta-Nehisi is often the person who will lean in and say, "Do you want to clarify what you were trying to say?" In 2008, he published a memoir, The Beautiful Struggle. I hope that you grab a copy of it at the end of this evening. The Beautiful Struggle, A Father, Two Sons, and an Unlikely Road to Manhood is the full title. His recent piece, published in The Atlantic, titled The Case for Reparations, intricately and provocatively traces the history of racism in the United States from slavery to recent examples of housing discrimination. I hope that you have all had a chance to read this piece. If you haven't, I'm giving you an assignment. You need to read this piece. You will have a better understanding of the country that you love, even though you might not love everything you read in that piece. I understand that there are a lot of students in the audience tonight. I'm giving you a particular assignment. You must read that piece, and you must understand how special it is to be in this theater tonight. I think it would be much like me being in high school and being able to watch James Baldwin on stage. Because for some of us, that's how we see Ta-Nehisi Coates. My dear friend Isabel Wilkerson calls him our James Baldwin. And that is truly the way that many of us see him. The Case for Reparations set a single-day traffic record for the magazine site at The Atlantic, The Atlantic's website. And the attention it has garnered has given him a platform and a forum to wrestle with questions of identity, both blackness and whiteness, questions of fairness and justice, and what it means for America to live up to its promise. Well, I'm going to promise you something. This is going to be a very special evening. I'm going to make way for the man that you've all come here to see. Please join me in welcoming Ta-Nehisi Coates.
I hope somebody was recording that, because I'm going to send that to my mother. Tell her I got an introduction from Michelle Norris. I have, you know, made my life into something. I'm joking, but that, you know, this is like a really, really special moment for me. You grow up and you listen to people, and you idolize people and you look up to people. And Michelle, you know, in her journalism has always been able to combine a kind of grace and intelligence at the same time. And I've always been deeply envious of that because all I know how to do is just pick up the battle axe, right, and just knock people upside the head, you know, in interviews. And so I say that it really is a high honor, you know, to be here and to receive that beautiful, beautiful introduction. Thank you so much, Michelle. Thank you. Thank you. Michelle alluded to this in the introduction. We're living in a particular time that is, in some ways, seems different, but may, in fact, not actually be very different at all. yesterday, I'm sure some of you, and maybe not all of you, went on the New York Times website or whatever, you know, media website, you know, you tend to frequent, and you saw a video of a police officer shooting a black man in the back, gunning him down, and then doing what appears to be planting evidence, you know, in him to justify what appears to be a cold-blooded murder. And I got a note. I was on the plane coming here, and I was, you know, getting ready to board, and I got a note from my politics editor, and he said, "Listen, I know you know you think about this stuff all the time. You care about this so much. There's so many people paying attention. You know, this would be a good time for you to write something." And I sat down and I tried to write, and it just felt like cheating because I realized I was just saying the same thing over and over and over again. The fact of the matter is when we have one of these incidents come up, we have this hyper-micro focus on the incident. You know, and we think about the police officer and how awful the police officer was and what, you know, police officer did in that act. And you know, I don't really have a beef with that. I'm not here to defend a police officer who shoots a man in the back. But we had a case a few weeks ago. There's a man in Atlanta who was leaping off of his balcony. He was having, you know, some sort of mental issues, and he was stark naked, and he was shot down too. I just came from Madison, Wisconsin, and the students up there were all afire for a young man up there who had gotten high on mushrooms and was chasing a car, and somebody called the cops, and somehow he ended up dead too. I come from, you know, New York City, where over the summer we had Eric Garner, you know, who was out on the street selling cigarettes, and somehow he ended up dead too. I think at some point, like, it's good to pause for a second, to even put the outrage and anger on pause for a second, and just back up a little bit and see if we can connect the dots. And one of the things I want to suggest to you is that there's a line running through the last 30 or 40 years in terms of how we deal with what should be social service in our cities. And what we have decided is that we will cut back on social service and we will send the police in to deal with every single issue. So this guy is like missing a taillight, and then a child support warrant comes up on him. We decide the way to deal with that is to send somebody in who has been authorized by the state to kill, to use as much force as he deems necessary. We have a gentleman who's having a mental health issue, and our way of responding to that is to send somebody in who is authorized to kill in the name of the state. We have somebody having a drug issue, and our response to that is to send in somebody who we've authorized to kill, to use as much force as he deems necessary. And if you know anything about the jurisprudence of this country, it's very, very hard, very, very hard to, you know, first of all, get a police officer to actually lose his job through the use of force, much less be convicted of anything. We have pretty much given carte blanche to officers to use as much force as necessary. Maybe that's right, maybe that's wrong. But the fact of the matter is we are deploying force to solve our problems. We are deploying people with guns. Our police officers are not drug counselors. Police officers are not mental health professionals. Police officers are not, you know, caseworkers, you know, for dealing with child support. But our answer is not to deploy people who have expertise in these fields somehow. It's to deploy police officers. And you can see this, like, logic running through, like, when Sandy Hook happened, the answer was to put guns in the hands of teachers, to make teachers more like the police, in fact. And the idea is that guns can solve all our problems, that we can, you know, deploy force in all our problems. And I would just, you know, suggest to you that it's not a mistake that we have, you know, had this, you know, decision, that we've decided that this is the way we want to answer our problems over the last 40 years, and that movement follows right off of the end of the civil rights movement. And so I think, you know, we could do ourselves a favor by just stepping back for a second. You know, I saw the mayor, he said he, you know, wanted to put body cameras, you know, on everybody. And, I'm for body cameras. But I think the question needs to be asked, why are we sending the police in the first place? Why are you deploying the police in the first place? It makes everybody feel good. You get your blood up when you get to talk about how bad this guy was. You know, anger serves a kind of purpose. We can all unify around our rage, you know, around the fact that a man should not be shot in the back and had a taser planted on. Well, that's an easy call. That's an easy call. The hard calls are the calls that cost money. This was not too far from what we saw down in Ferguson also. I mean, if you think about it, right? We had the Justice Department report that comes out, and we find that basically Ferguson has turned its police force into a tax collection agency, that the police are being used basically as a funding mechanism for municipal government. Why is that happening? What's going on? There's a broader social safety net, a broader social question that confronts us, besides, you know, what is bigger than body cams, it's bigger than a few bad police officers. I've been thinking about this for some time. I've been thinking about it actually since I was a child in West Baltimore, to be honest. Didn't even know I was thinking of it, but I was. And I've come to this point where I have a child myself who's growing up in this time, you know, and is becoming, you know, politically conscious in this time, you know, and is having, you know, things revealed to him in this time. And, you know, the president that he will remember most will be an African-American president. You know, and yet he sees in his city, you know, what's going on with Aragon. He saw what happened down in Ferguson. You know, he's seeing, you know, what happened yesterday down in South Carolina. It's just too many cases to name, to be honest. It's just way, way, way too many. And it's affecting his consciousness. And I had an idea about a year and a half ago, because this really, you know, goes back, to try to explain to my son, to give him some insight into what it meant to become conscious in this world, how you were supposed to deal with yourself, how you were supposed to carry yourself. And as it turns out, you know, I had, you know, quite a bit of experiences. I mentioned earlier that I've been thinking about this since I was a really, really young man. Because the question of your body, the question of your bodily safety is so key to African-American identity. It's been key since the moment we got here as enslaved peoples. And it has remained key if you look at the kind of neighborhoods that we tend to grow up in, the kind of exposure to violence and violation of our bodies that we experience. The question of your body is so key. And the police, you know, a killing by the police, being shot in the back and having a taser planted on you, is just a superlative form of that. But it takes so many other forms and, you know, afflicts us in so many ways. And I got to thinking, how can I talk to my son about this? And as it happened, I had a book contract for a book I hadn't written yet. Problem, solution. See how that works? No, but I am serious. I mean, I wouldn't, you know, write a book out of nothing. This was a, you know, a very, very real question. And about that time, I had finished writing the case for reparations, which, you know, if not, you know, including too much about police violence, is really, you know, trying to get folks to look past, you know, to open the conversation up a little bit more, to pause and get beyond the immediacy, you know, of the moment, which we as journalists, you know, sometimes have a bias towards, and the public at large has a bias towards. Well, I'm going to get to the point. I have a book coming out in October. We're almost done. We're actually almost done. I think Galleys are going to be out in a month, you know, where, you know, I'm just doing the last part of haggling. And this thing happened yesterday, and this book is all about this thing and how you cope with this thing. When I was a young man at Howard University, I had a friend by the name of Prince Jones. When people will say things like twice as good, that's who Prince Jones is. When your parents urge you to go be twice as good, that's who Prince Jones is, or I should say was. 6'4", you know, he'd been an athlete in high school, handsome, big, beautiful, smile, you know, intelligent, deeply, deeply religious. He was born again, and just incredibly, incredibly smart. Prince was from the Dallas area, and he attended a magnet school in Texas, and the magnet school was for math and science, and you know, for the entire 4 years he was there, he was the only African-American student there. Texas is a big state, and, you know, you can imagine being the only black kid there is pretty incredible. And his mom had been, you know, a relatively affluent. She had grown up in grinding poverty, had rose, you know, become a radiologist and was doing pretty well. And she gave Prince all the best things that he wanted. And that meant, you know, because, you know, she wanted the best for him, and in large respect, he didn't really grow up around African Americans. And then, you know, when he turned 18 and it was time for him to go away, he decided he wanted to come to Howard University. There are generally two types of people that come to Howard University, where I went to school. There are people who, you know, have grown up around nothing but black people and, you know, kind of don't know any better, like me. And then there are people who have grown up around white people and are just tired and want to be around people that look like them, you know? And they're not tired because white people, you know, have lighter skin than them. You know, they're not tired because white people have blonde hair, you know. They are tired because they, you know, spend a great deal of their scholastic experience explaining themselves, interpreting themselves, being a spokesperson for other groups of people. And at Howard University, you kind of were just free to be. And I met Prince Jones there, and I adored Prince Jones, and I loved him, and he's just a beautiful guy. I can remember the last time I saw him, I was at the gym, and he was, you know, doing really well, and he was, you know, about to finish up at Howard. And, you know, and every time I talked to him, you know, you would just have this warm, you know, sort of glowing feeling as you walked away. And in September of 2000, Prince Jones was driving from Prince George's County, and he had dropped his daughter off to, you know, stay with some friends for the night, and he was going to see his fiance. And the police in Prince George's County were out looking for somebody who had stolen an officer's gun, and they confused his Jeep with this gentleman's. The gentleman who they confused him with was roughly like 5'8 or something like that. Prince was about 6'4. They follow Prince Jones out of Prince George's County through Washington, D.C., into Virginia, within mere yards of his fiance's house, and they shot and they killed him. And I was at home, and I picked up I was checking through the papers, and I saw the papers, and Prince George's County has one of the most brutal police departments. I'm sure Michelle knows all about this. One of the most brutal police departments in the country. Had at that time, definitely. And so to hear that they had shot somebody, you know, under such circumstances was not a particularly original insight. And I remember, you know, the first time I saw it, I just kind of looked away. And then the next day it was news again, and I saw that the person who had gotten shot was from Howard University. And on the third day I looked, and there was a picture of my brother, Prince Jones. And it was devastating. It was utterly, utterly devastating. But not as devastating as the fact that the officer who shot him was never charged with anything. Not as devastating as the fact that the officer who shot him was returned to the streets to go out and patrol other people. Not as devastating as later finding out that that officer had a history of lying in every single case that he had been involved in, the prosecutor had to throw out. That was devastating. That was devastating. And I carried that with me, and I have carried that with me for so long. And when it came time to do this book, I was so interested in, you know, just going back and trying to explore what that meant to me. And I wanted to explain it to my son. And in the course of doing that, I went to see Prince Jones's mother, who lives in Philadelphia. And I just wanted to talk to her a little bit about her son. I had never met her. I wanted to hear about him through her eyes. And I'm going to take a second tonight. Michelle, was your water on the right or the left? Oh, okay, all right. Michelle whispered to me about which water I could take. You didn't take any, though, right? All right, I'm going to take the right. I may need both. I went to see his mother, and I, you know, obviously his mother had a very, very different perspective. I had never met her before. I'd seen her at one of the observances, and it was devastating. And so I want to read to you tonight about going to see the mother of Prince Jones. Mabel Jones is her name. The book is written as an address to my son, so when you see the U's, just imagine me talking to my 14-year-old son, Samari. I did not die in my aimless youth. I did not perish in the agony of not knowing. I was not jailed. I had proven to myself that there was some other way out there. I felt myself to be among the survivors of some great natural disaster, some plague, some avalanche or earthquake. And now, living in the wake of decimation and having arrived at a land that I once considered mythical, everything seemed cast in halo. Your route will be different. It must be. You knew things at 11 that I did not know when I was 25. When I was 11, my highest priority was the simple security of my body. My life was the immediate negotiation of violence within my house and without. But already you have expectations. I see that in you. Survival and safety are not enough. Your hopes, your dreams, if you will, leave me with an array of warring emotions. I am so very proud of you, your openness, your ambition, your aggression, your intelligence. My job in the little time we have left together is to match that intelligence with wisdom. Part of that wisdom is understanding what you were given, a city where all the gay bars are unremarkable to you, a soccer team on which half the players speak some other language. What I am saying is that it does not all belong to you, that the beauty in you is not strictly yours and largely is the result of enjoying an abnormal amount of security in your black body. Perhaps that is why when you discovered the killer of Mike Brown would go unpunished, you told me you had to go. Perhaps that is why you were crying, because in that moment you understood that even your relatively privileged security can never match a sustained assault launched in the name of the dream. Our current politics tell you that should you fall victim to such an assault and lose your body, it somehow must be your fault. Trayvon Martin's hoodie got him killed. Jordan Davis's loud music did the same. John Crawford should never have touched the rifle on display. Kajimmy Powell should have known better than to be crazy. And all of them should have had fathers, even the ones who had fathers, even you. Without its own justification, the dream would collapse upon itself. You first learned this from Michael Brown. I first learned it from Prince Jones. The right to capture our bodies, built on a foundation of phrenology, is so ingrained that it is barely questioned. Michael Brown did not die as so many of his defenders supposed, and still, the question behind the questions are never asked. Should assaulting an officer of the state be a capital offense, rendered without trial, with the officer as judge and executioner? Is that what we wish civilization to be? And all the time, the dreamers are pillaging Ferguson for municipal governance, and they are torturing Muslims, and their drones are bombing wedding parties, and the dreamers are quoting Martin Luther King and exalting nonviolence for the weak and maximum guns for the strong. Each time a police officer engages us, death, injury, maiming is possible. It is not enough to say that this is more true of anyone or more true of criminals. The moment the officers began the pursuit of Prince Jones, his life was in danger. The dreamers accept this as the cost of doing business. They accept your body as currency because it is their tradition. As slaves, we were this country's windfall, the down payment on its freedom. After the ruin and liberation of the Civil War came redemption for the unrepentant South and reunion, and our bodies became this country's second mortgage. In the New Deal, we were their guest room, their finished basement. And today, with a sprawling prison system, which has turned the warehousing of black bodies into a jobs program for dreamers and a lucrative investment for dreamers, today, when 8% of the world's prisoners are black men, our bodies have refinanced the dream of being white. Black life is cheap, but in America, black bodies are a natural resource of incomparable value. In the years after Prince Jones died, I thought often of those who were left to make their lives in the shadow of his death. I thought of his fiance, and I wondered what it would mean to see their future lives upended with no explanation. I wondered what she would tell his daughter. I wondered how his daughter would imagine her father, when she would miss him, how she would detail the loss. But mostly I wondered about Prince's mother. And the question I mostly asked was always the same. How did she live? I searched for her phone number online. I emailed her. She responded. Then I called and made an appointment to visit. I could not imagine how she possibly lived. But living she was just outside of Philadelphia in a small gated community of affluent homes. It was a rainy Tuesday when I arrived. I had taken the train in from New York and then picked up a rental car. I was thinking a lot of Prince in those months before. You and your mother and I had gone to homecoming at Howard, and so many of our friends were there, and Prince was not. Dr. Jones greeted me at the door. She was lovely, polite, brown. She appeared to be somewhere in that range between 40 and 70 years when it becomes difficult to precisely ascertain a black woman's precise age. She was well composed, given the subject of our conversation, and for most of the visit, I struggled to separate how she actually felt from what I felt she must be feeling. What I felt right then was that she was smiling through her pained eyes, that the reason for my visit had spread sadness like a dark quilt over the whole house. I seemed to recall music, jazz or gospel, playing in the background. But conflicting with that, I also remember a deep quiet overcoming everything. I thought that perhaps she had been crying. I could not tell for sure. She led me into her large living room. There was no one else in the house. It was early January. Her Christmas tree was still standing at the end of the room, and there were stockings bearing the name of her daughter and her lost son. And there was a framed picture of him, Prince Jones, on a display table. She brought me water in a heavy glass. She drank tea. She told me that she was born and raised outside of Opelousas, Louisiana, that her ancestors had been enslaved in that same region, and as a consequence of that enslavement, a fear echoed down through the ages. It first became clear to me when I was 4, she told me. My mother and I were going into the city. We got on the Greyhound bus. I was behind my mother. She wasn't holding my hand at the time, and I plopped down in the first seat I found. A few minutes later, my mother was looking for me, and she took me to the back of the bus and explained why I couldn't sit there. We were very poor, and most of the black people around us, who I knew, were poor also. And the images I had of white America were going into the city and seeing who was behind the counter in the stores and seeing who my mother worked for. It became clear there was a distance. This chasm makes itself known to us in all kinds of ways. A little girl wanders home at age 7 after being teased in school and asks her parents, "Are we niggas? And what does this mean?" Sometimes it is subtle, the simple observation of who lives where and works what jobs and who does not. Sometimes it is all at once. I have never asked you how you personally became aware of the distance. I don't think I want to know. But I know that it has happened to you already, that you have deduced that you are privileged and yet still different from other privileged children because you are the bearer of a body more fragile than any other in this country. What I want you to know is that this is not your fault, even if it is ultimately your responsibility. It is your responsibility because you are surrounded by the sleepers, by the dreamers. It has nothing to do with how you wear your pants or how you style your hair. The breach is as intentional as policy, as intentional as the forgetting that follows. The breach allows for the efficient sorting of the plundered from the plunderers, the enslaved from the enslavers, sharecroppers from landholders, cannibals from food. Dr. Jones was reserved. She was what people once referred to as a lady, and in that sense reminded me of my grandmother, who was a single mother in the projects but always spoke as though she had nice things. And when Dr. Jones described her motive for escaping the dirt that marked the sharecropper life of her father and all the others around her, when she remembered herself saying, "I'm not gonna live like this," I saw the iron in her eyes, and I remembered the iron in my grandmother's eyes. You must barely remember her by now. You were 6 when she died. I remember her, of course, but by the time I knew her, her exploits, how for once she scrubbed white people's floors during the day and went to school at night, were legend. But I could still feel the power and rectitude that propelled her out of the projects and into home ownership. It was the same power I felt in the presence of Dr. Jones. When she was in 2nd grade, she and another girl made a pact that they would both become doctors, and she held up her end of the bargain. But first, she integrated the high school in her town. At the beginning, she fought the white children who insulted her. At the end, they voted her class president. She ran track. It was a great entree, she told me, but it only brought her so far into their world. At football games, the other students would cheer the black star running back, and then when a black player on the other team got the ball, they'd yell, "Kill that nigga, kill that nigga." They would yell this sitting right next to her, as though she really were not there. She gave Bible recitations as a child and told me the story of her recruitment into this business. Her mother took her to an audition for the junior choir. Afterwards, the choir director said, "Honey, I think you should talk." She was laughing lightly now. not uproariously, still in control of her body. I felt she was warming up. And as she talked of the church, I thought of your grandfather, the one you know, and how his first intellectual inventions were founded in the recitation of Bible passages. I thought of your mother, who did the same. And I thought of my own distance from the church that has so often been the support for our people. I often wonder if in that distance I've missed something, some notions of cosmic hope, some wisdom beyond my mean physical perception of the world, something beyond my body that I might have transmitted to you. I wondered this at that particular moment because something beyond anything I had ever understood drove Mabel Jones into an exceptional life. She went to college on a full scholarship. She went to med school at Louisiana State University. She served in the Navy. She took up radiology. She did not know any other black radiologists. I assumed this would have been hard on her, but she was insulted by the assumption. She could not acknowledge any discomfort, and she did not speak of herself as remarkable because it conceded too much, because it sanctified tribal expectations when the only expectation that mattered should be rooted in an assessment of Mabel Jones. And by those lights, there was nothing surprising in her success because Mabel Jones was always pedal to the floor, not over or around, but through. And if she was going to do it, it must be done to death. Her disposition toward life was that of an elite athlete who knows the opponent is dirty and the refs are on the take, but also knows the championship is one game away. She called her son, Prince Jones, Rocky, in honor of her grandfather who went by Rock. I asked about his children because the fact is that I had not known Prince all of that well. He was among the people I would be happy to see at a party who I would describe to a friend as a good brother, though I could not really account for all of his comings and goings. So she sketched them for me so I may better understand. She said that he'd once hammered a nail into an electrical socket and shorted out the whole house. She said that he once dressed himself in a suit and got down on one knee and sung three times a lady to her. She said he'd gone to private schools his entire life, schools filled with dreamers, but he made friends wherever he went, in Louisiana and later in Texas. I asked how his friend's parents treated her. She said, "By then, I was chief of radiology at the local hospital, and so they treated me with respect." She said this with no love in her eyes, coldly, as though she were explaining a mathematical function, which is exactly what she was doing. Like his mother, Prince was smart. In high school, he was admitted to a Texas magnet school for math and science, where students acquire college credit. Despite the school drawing from a state with roughly the population of Angola, Australia, or Afghanistan, Prince was the only black child. I asked Dr. Jones if she had wanted him to go to Howard. She smiled and said no. Then she added, "It is so nice to be able to talk about this." This relaxed me a little because I could think of myself as something more than an intrusion. I asked her where she wanted him to go for college, and she said, "Harvard. And if not Harvard, Princeton. And if not Princeton, Yale. And if not Yale, Columbia. And if not Columbia, Stanford." He was that caliber of student. But like at least one third of all the students who came to Howard, Prince was tired of having to represent to other people. These Howard students were not like me. They were the children of the Jackie Robinson elite, whose parents rose up out of ghettos and the sharecropping fields, went out into the suburbs, only to find that they carried the mark with them and could not escape. Even when they succeeded, as so many did, they were singled out, made examples of, transfigured into parables of diversity. They were symbols and markers, never children or young adults. And so they came to Howard University to be normal, and even more, to see how broad the black normal really is. Prince did not apply to Harvard. He did not apply to Princeton. He did not apply to Yale, nor Columbia, nor Stanford. He only wanted to come to the Mecca. I asked Dr. Jones if she regretted Prince choosing Howard. She gasped. It was as though I had pushed too hard on a bruise. "No," she said. "I regret that he's dead." She said this with great composure and greater pain. She said this with all the odd poise and direction that the American injury demands of you. Have you ever taken a hard look at those pictures from the sit-ins in the 60s? I mean a hard, serious look. Have you ever looked at the faces? The faces are neither angry nor sad nor joyous. They betray almost no emotion. They look out past their tormentors, past us, and focus on something way beyond anything ever known to me. I think they are fastened to their God, a God whom I cannot know and in whom I do not believe, but God or not, the armor is all over them and it is real. Or perhaps it is not armor at all. So many of these protesters were injured, some of them so much that they would stand with the man who murdered Martin Luther King Jr. Perhaps it is a kind of life extension, a kind of loan allowing you to take the assaults heaped upon you now and you pay down the debt later. Whatever it is, that same look is what I see in those pictures, noble and vacuous. That was the look I saw in Mabel Jones. It was in her sharp brown eyes, which welled but did not break. She held so much under her control. And I was sure in the days since her Rocky was plundered, since her lineage was robbed, they had demanded nothing less. And she could not lean on her country for help. When it came to her son, Dr. Jones's country did what it did best. It forgot him. The forgetting is habit. It is yet another necessary component of the dream. They have forgotten the scale of theft that enriched them in slavery, the terror that allowed them for a century to pilfer the vote, the segregationist policy that gave them their suburbs. They have forgotten because to remember would tumble them out of the beautiful dream and force them to live down here with us, down here in the world. I am convinced that the dreamers, at least the dreamers of today, would rather live white than live free. In the dream, they are Buck Rogers. In the dream, they are Prince Aragorn. In the dream, they are an entire race of Skywalkers. To awaken them is to reveal that they are an empire of men, like all empires of men, and are built on the destruction of the body. It is to stain their nobility, to make them vulnerable, fallible, breakable humans. Dr. Jones was asleep when the phone rang. It was 5 a.m. and on the phone was a detective telling her she should drive to Washington. Rocky was in the hospital. Rocky had been shot. She drove with her daughter. She was sure he was still alive. She paused several times as she explained this. She went directly to the ICU. Rocky was not there. A group of men with authority, doctors, lawyers, detectives perhaps, took her into a room and told her that he was gone. She paused again. She did not cry. Composure was too important now. It was unlike anything I had felt before, she told me. It was extremely physically painful, so much so that whenever I thought of him, all I could do was pray and ask for mercy. I thought I was going to lose my mind and go crazy. I felt sick. I felt like I was dying. I asked if she expected that the police officer who shot Prince would be charged. She said, yes. Her voice was a cocktail of emotions. She spoke like an American, with the same expectations of fairness, even fairness belated and begrudged that she took into medical school all those days ago. And she spoke like a black woman, with all the pain that undercuts those exact feelings. I now wondered about her daughter who'd been recently married. There was a picture on display of this daughter and her new husband. She was not optimistic. She was intensely worried about her daughter bringing a son into America because she could not save him. She could not secure his body from the ritual violence that had claimed her son. She compared America to Rome. She said she thought the glory days of the country had long passed, and even those glory days were sullied. They had been built on the bodies of others. And we can't get the message, she said. We don't understand that we are embracing our deaths. I asked Dr. Jones if her mother was still alive. She told me that her mother had passed away in 2002 at the age of 89. I asked Dr. Jones how her mother had taken Prince's death, and her voice retreated into an almost whisper, and Dr. Jones said, I don't know that she did. She alluded to 12 years a slave. There he was, she said, speaking of Solomon Northup. He had means. He had a family. He was living like a human being. And one racist act took him back. And the same is true of me. I spent years developing a career, acquiring assets, engaging responsibilities, and one racist act. It's all it takes. And then she talked again of all that she had through great industry, through unceasing labor, acquired in the long journey from grinding poverty. She spoke of how her children had been raised in luxury, annual ski trips, jaunts off to Europe. She said that when her daughter was studying Shakespeare in high school, she took her to England. And when her daughter got her driver's license at 16, a Mazda 626 was waiting in front. I sensed some connection to this desire to give and the raw poverty of her youth. I sensed it was all as much for her as it was for her children. She said Prince had never taken to material things. He loved to read. He loved to travel. But when he turned 23, she bought him a Jeep. She had a huge purple bow put on it. She told me that she could still see him there, looking at that Jeep and simply saying, "Thank you, Mom." Without interruption, she added, "And that was the Jeep he was killed in." After I left, I sat in the car idle for a few minutes. I thought of all that Prince's mother had invested in him, and I thought of all that was lost. I thought of the loneliness that had sent him to the Mecca and how the Mecca, how we could not save him, how we ultimately cannot save ourselves. I thought back on the sit-ins, the protesters with their stoic faces, the ones I'd once scorned for hurling their bodies at all the worst things in life. Perhaps they knew something terrible about the world. Perhaps they so willingly parted with the security and the sanctity of the black body because neither security nor sanctity actually existed in the first place. And all those old photographs from the 1960s, all those films I beheld of black people prostrate before clubs and dogs were not simply shameful. Indeed, were not shameful at all. They were just true. We are captured, brother, surrounded by the majoritarian bandits of America. And this has happened here, in our only home. And the terrible truth is that we cannot will ourselves to an escape on our own. Perhaps that was, is, the hope of the movement, to awaken the dreamers, to rouse them to the facts of what their need to be white, their need to talk like they are white, their need to think like they are white, what it is that that dream has done, and all the design flaws it has exposed of humanity and what it has done to the world. But you cannot arrange your life around them. You cannot arrange your life around the infinitesimal chance of the dreamers coming into consciousness. Our moment, our time here is just too brief. Our bodies are too precious, and you are here now, and you must live. And there is so much out here for you to live for, not just in someone else's country, but in your own home. The warmth of dark energies that drew me to the Mecca, that drew out Prince Jones, the warmth of our particular world is beautiful, no matter how brief and how breakable. I think back to our trip to homecoming. I think back to the warm blast rolling over us. We were at the football game. We were sitting in the bleachers with old friends and their children, caring neither for fumbles or first downs. I remember looking towards the goalpost and watching a pack of alumni cheerleaders so enamored with Howard University that they had donned their old colors and took out the uniforms a little bit so they'd fit. I remember them dancing. They'd shake, freeze, shake again, and when the crowd yelled, "Do it, do it, do it," a black woman two rows in front of me in her tightest jeans stood and shook as though she was not somebody's mama, and the past 20 years had barely been a week. I remember walking down to the tailgate party without you. I could not bring you, but I have no problem telling you what I saw. The entire diaspora around me. Hustlers, lawyers, cappers, busters, doctors, barbers, deltas, drunkards, geeks, and nerds. The DJ hollered into the mic. The young folks pushed towards him. A young man pulled out a bottle of cognac and twisted off the cap. A girl with him smiled, tilted her head back, and bobbed and laughed. 50 strains of marijuana were washing over me. 50 strains of black people were washing over me. And I felt myself disappearing into all of their bodies. The birthmark of damnation faded, and I could feel the weight of my arms, and I could hear the heave in my breath, and I was not talking then because there was no point. That was a moment, a joyous moment beyond the dream, a moment imbued by a power more gorgeous than any voting rights bill. This power, this black power, originates in a view of the American galaxy taken from a dark and essential planet. Black power is the dungeon side view of Monticello, which is to say, the view that is taken in struggle. And black power births a kind of understanding that illuminates all the galaxies in their truest colors, even the dreamers, lost in their great reverie, feel it. For it is Billy that they reach for in sadness. And Mobb Deep is what they holler in boldness. And Isley is what they hum in love. And Dre is what they yell in revelry. And Aretha is the last sound they hear before dying. We have made something down here. We have taken the one-drop rules of the dreamers and we have flipped them. They made us into a race. We made ourselves into a people. Here at Howard, at the Mecca, under pain of selection, we have made a home, as do black people on summer blocks marked with needles, vials, and hopscotch squares, as did black people dancing it out at rent parties, as do black people at their family reunions where we all regard each other like the survivors of catastrophe, as do black people toasting their cognac and German beers, passing their blunts and debating MCs, as do all of us who have voyaged through death to life upon these shores. That was the love, the power that drew in Prince Jones. The power is not divinity, but a deep knowledge of how fragile everything, even the dream, especially the dream, really is. Sitting in the car, I thought of Dr. Jones's predictions of national doom. I had heard such predictions all my life from Malcolm X and all of his posthumous followers who hollered that the dreamers must reap what they sow. I saw the same predictions in the words of Marcus Garvey, who promised to return in a whirlwind of vengeful ancestors, an army of Middle Passage undead. No, I left the Mecca knowing that that was all too pat, knowing that should the dreamers reap what they had sown, we would reap it right along with them. Plunder has matured into habit and addiction. The people who could author the mechanized death of our ghettos, the mass rape of private prisons, then engineer their own forgetting must inevitably plunder much more. This is not a belief in prophecy, but in the seductiveness of cheap gasoline. Once the dream's parameters were caged by technology and by the limits of horsepower and wind, but the dreamers have improved themselves. And the damming of seas for voltage, the extraction of coal, the transmuting of oil into food have enabled them in expansion and plunder with no known precedent. And this revolution has freed the dreamers to plunder not just the bodies of humans, but the body of the earth itself. The earth is not our creation. It has no respect for us. It has no use for us. And its vengeance is not the fire in the cities, but the fire in the sky. Something more fierce than Marcus Garvey is riding in on the whirlwind. Something more awful than all of our African ancestors is rising with the seas. The two phenomena are known to each other. It was the cotton that passed through our chained hands that inaugurated this industrial age. It is the flight from us that sent them sprawling into the subdivided woods, and the method of transport through these new subdivisions across that great sprawl is the automobile, the noose around the neck of the earth, and ultimately the dreamers themselves. I drove away from the house of Mabel Jones thinking of all of this. I drove away, as always, thinking of you. I do not believe we can stop them, Samari, because they must ultimately stop themselves. And still I urge you to struggle. Struggle for the memory of your ancestors. Struggle for wisdom. Struggle for the warmth of Mecca. Struggle for your grandmother and grandfather. Struggle for your name. But do not struggle for them. Hope for them. Pray for them if you are so moved. But do not spend your struggle on anyone else's conversion. The dreamers will have to learn to struggle themselves, as we did, to understand that the field for their dream, the stage where they have painted themselves white, is the deathbed of us all. Self-deception has matured into habit. It is the same habit that endangers the planet, the same habit that sees our bodies stowed away in prisons and ghettos. I saw these ghettos driving back from Dr. Jones's home. They were the same ghettos I had seen in Chicago all those years ago, the same ghettos where my mother was raised, the same ghettos where my father was raised. Through the windshields, I saw the mark of these ghettos, the abundance of beauty shops, churches, liquor stores, and crumbling housing, and I felt the old fear. Through the windshield, I saw the rain coming down in sheets. Thank you. I just wanted to quickly say, so I was watching my time. It looks like I got 250 seconds and counting, so I'm try to use it really quickly. I just wanted to say, you know, I don't know if there are any writers here, but I made the joke about writing a book. But the fact of the matter is, I've been thinking about Prince since the day, you know, he got gunned down. And I've written about him in other forms just a little bit here and there. And I have sat with this for so long, you know, and I have no idea. Well, I have some idea, but no total idea what his mother is sitting with, what his sister is sitting with the people who really, really knew him on an intimate level are sitting with. But I wanted to read that tonight because when you watch that tape of that man being shot in the back like that, I want you to remember two things. First of all, for the majority of us, there is no tape. There is no tape. We just, you know, die. That's it. That's it. You know, he said Prince had, you know, backed an SUV into, you know, an officer's car and had tried to kill him. It matches no known description of any Prince Jones that anybody ever knew. The second thing is to remember that, you know, when you have these folks die, that they had families, that they were people, that they were really, really full functioning humans. And the taking of that life is just such a huge, huge crime, I would go so far as to say. And for so much of our history, our, you know, kind of governance, our style of governance, our democracy, I would go so far as to say, is pinned on exactly that kind of taking of life. I really hate to say that, you know, but across American history, this is not particularly unusual. This is not particularly unique. I hope you're horrified. You should be horrified. But it won't be the last time. We'll be having this conversation again and again and again and again until we decide to look at this on some deeper issue, deeper level. Thank you so much.
That concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
Ta-Nehisi, thank you so much for sharing that with us. Have you read that or have you shared it with an audience before?
In different iterations a couple other times when I was in the course of working on it, yeah. It's much more finished, what you guys got to hear.
You mentioned things that were contemporary, so
yeah.
I was wondering if...
Yeah, so that's, yes, I've been able to make changes. Yeah.
You use an interesting word, and before I ask this question, I just want to... You ask the audience to think about two things, given that we've all seen, or most of us have probably seen this video. I wonder if we should be thinking about something else also. With the videos that we've seen in the death of Walter Scott and the death of Eric Garner and the death of Tamir Rice are potentially an accessory to justice, but they also mean that we see black life extinguished mm-hmm. on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. And that's something that we've gotten used to. And you know, I said this earlier on social media, that my father's generation and his father's generation were scarred by the memory mm-hmm. of seeing black lives extinguished, and they bore those scars, and those who saw it bore those scars in a special way,
right.
as opposed to those who just heard tell of it. Mm-hmm. We all see it now,
right.
and our children see it too, and I wonder if you worry about that.
I worry a great deal about it. I mean, it's always the possibility of... And you know, I just wanted, again, you know, it was one of the reasons why I wrote the piece the way it did. You know, people become like names to you, and then they kind of get dehumanized, and, you know, you lose, like, all of the texture that makes a human being, as opposed to just, you know, some black dude who's running and they just get shot. If we forget that these people are human beings, you know, I think we lose something. You know, we almost surrender to the crime in a particular way. I always have like just a weird reaction to these sorts of things. I watch it and I, you know, I have like this kind of shell that comes over me where I don't quite process it completely. I was way more emotional reading that tonight than I was when I was actually writing it. Mm-hmm. Actually wasn't that, you know, emotional when I was writing it. And I suspect that maybe other black people do the same sort of thing. You know, where you put it in some sort of box. And maybe we get used to putting things like that into boxes, you know, because we can't necessarily cope in the moment with them. But it comes out, you know, it kind of seeps out of you. I do worry about that, you know, and I worry about the normalization of that kind of brutality. It's why I'm, I guess, in part a little suspicious of like how much cameras will ultimately help. You know, I would much rather us think more about when we're deploying force and why.
So cameras are less necessary.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I'm not against cameras, but I just feel like it's kind of a Band-Aid, you know?
I want to ask you about what you just read to us this evening. You used a very interesting term. You used the term dreamers.
Mm-hmm.
And that's interesting on a number of levels, because dreamers means one thing when you talk about immigration debate in this
right.
country. It means something else when you talk about civil rights history.
Yes.
And it is a word that is attached to a man who did quite a lot, but we remember him most especially for having a dream.
Right.
And the dream is usually associated with the dream of you know, moving towards something better in the civil rights movement. But you use it in a very, very different way here. And I want you to explain how and why and what the artifice is there.
Yeah, so I think it's... There's a lot going on there, whether it works or not.
By dreamers, are you referring to white Americans?
Yes, you're right. You have it. Yes, you are. You're correct. You caught it. And where where the phrase I use in the text is the people who believe that they are white. You know, I tried to actually not, you know, it's sort of a literary device, not to say white America, mm-hmm. not to say white people, to say the people who believe themselves to be white. And that, you know, you started talking about James Baldwin. That's what Baldwin, you know, wrote. You know, he had this, you know, great with because they believe they are white. And that was deeply, deeply wise. And I'm going to get to your question about dreamers within this. The popular conception of the way racism happens in this country is the idea that you have a group of people who, you know, came to America who are intrinsically and on some deep level different from each other. On a genetic level, in fact, I would argue. And so there's a race of black people who were brought here from Africa. There's a race of white people who, you know, came here from Europe. There's a race of Asian people, it sounds awkward even coming out of my mouth, who came here. And then they met a race of, you know, American people who were here, and there was conflict because all of these people were of different races. And we
even
have a
though race itself is a construct.
That's it. That's exactly it. That's exactly it. But that's not, you know, how we, and I would actually push it further, Michelle, not even just a construct, but a construct that is a direct result of racism. And so it's not that we have different races who can't get along and, you know, just, you know, sort of look at each other and decide it's natural for you to be my slave or for me to go upside your head or for me to shoot you in the back as you're running away. Racism came first and then race. Racism is the way by which someone who's employing racism justifies the pun. It says, you are over here, you're in a different box. There is no concept of race in America that one can, you know, talk about in history that is divorced from exercising power over other groups of people. There's no, you know, way of doing it. And that's embedded in a lot of our dialogue. You know, the idea that it's race and not racism. In fact, you know, we don't really say the word racism. We don't say the problem of racism. We say the problem of race has been with us. We say we need more racial diversity. We say, you know, we need to...
as opposed to racism eradication.
That's right. That's exactly it. I mean, we just don't... We are hesitant to actually use the word. We say race still haunts us today, not racism, you know.
But you use this term that is also about something that is ephemeral, dreamer.
Yes. And so one of the things that I think is that... from that, it's sort of this notion about how people have appropriated that speech. And I would go so far as to say how people have shrunk Dr. Martin Luther King into that speech. And it's a kind of speech that, you know, at least as it's rendered, you know, I wouldn't put that on the speech itself, but as it's rendered, it gives people great comfort in being American and great comfort in, you know, in their system of governance. One of the things that, you know, I wanted to do is really interrogate, you know, in my actual labeling, you know, how we folded that into ourselves, you know, and how, you know, dreaming is cool, but it also connotes sleeping. Mm-hmm. And that's really what's implicit in that. You know, that folks are, you know, actually asleep. They are not just dreaming. That part of, you know, getting to the dream is actually being asleep.
Mm-hmm.
And I found myself, you know, in the course of writing it, you know, challenged in, well, you know, people say, well, you know, folks are blind to racism, folks aren't quite seeing it, folks aren't quite understanding it, and I, you know, went back to this idea of just being asleep, you know, and then, you know, dreaming, being in a dream world, you know, almost.
So you're writing to Samara. You directly address him, but you're also directly addressing another audience.
Yes.
You're directly addressing white America.
I like to not think about it that way. Am I?
Yeah.
I'll leave that to you. I'll leave that to you. I mean, you know, I try.
No, and I said in the
not to
tell on any of you.
Right.
But I always like to sit in an audience. Wherever I, you know, if I'm at the conventions, I leave the stage or the place that I run away from the pen that they put the journalist in, mm-hmm. and try to get into a space because I want to absorb mm-hmm. it with the mm-hmm. With the audience, mm-hmm. and I think I absorbed something in this audience, mm-hmm. and it felt like there was another message there in telling your son. Maybe it's like you play pool, the rim shot.
No,
there's the intended target, but on the way it's the layup.
Okay.
You know,
I get that.
But there, and I wondered if that was intentional in talking to your son, if you were also, as you were writing this, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Talking to, I won't say white America, but those in America who hold the reins of power.
Okay, all right.
Whoever they happen
yes.
to be.
Yes. So I am aware that people besides my son will read the book, and I was aware of that when I was writing. But I didn't want to write that way. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to write. Like, I'm aware that, like, you have awareness, it's not just you, it's not just your kid, and it's not even just black people. Hopefully not just black people. I mean, you want the book to be as well read as possible. But I didn't want that to shape my, the way I approached it, mm-hmm. artistically. I was aware that that would happen, but I tried to put myself in the mode of writing to Samari, and that actually has a disciplining effect. Because it means that you can't say certain things, you can't, use language that he wouldn't understand, even at 15. And it actually helped, clean out a lot of the prose. I had to write in this really, really clean way. Me and my editor have this thing called the Samari test. This is before I even started writing this. If Samari understands...
What is the Samari test?
If Samari understands it, then it's well-written.
Okay.
Because it's clear. Because Samari's a very intelligent...
That's interesting, because most of us have that. I have the Betty test. That's
oh, do you really?
Mother. Would Betty understand this?
Right, right, right.
Can I make her understand credit default swaps?
No, but I think that's a great test. That's a great test because ultimately, the job of the writer is to explain something that's very, very complicated and very, in as clear language as possible. And you have to do that without, taking away any of the nuance.
Right.
Or any of that. I mean, you have to be as nuanced as you can. And, I mean, somebody's getting older now. At the time we did that, he was about 13. And he's, he was a very precocious reader. He read all these people. He read Vonnegut and, E.L. Doctorow. So it was clear that the boy could read. So if he was looking at me and saying, I don't understand, I have failed. I have failed. And so it was a very disciplining to write to him. And say, okay, what did you not get? What did you get?
I want to talk to you not just about this piece, but also about your body of work. You are a man of great curiosities. You have a very active mind. It's one of the things that I've always admired about you. There was a time when Ta-Nehisi was obsessed with the Civil War. And why people of color didn't know enough about the Civil War, and so you were visiting Civil War battlefields all over America. You recently learned how to speak French.
I'm learning. I'm still in the midst of it.
And when you worked on your piece on reparations, mm-hmm. you just were like Pac-Man.
Right.
You just really dove into it. Is that something, has that always been part of your character?
Yes, it's the reason why I was a horrible student.
Because I think of
student.
You as, really?
Yes,
because I
exactly
thought it would
I
make you a fantastic student.
No, it made me a terrible student because, the beauty of journalism is, if you get to a decent enough place, you get to pick your topic. And it rewards you being insane about, one thing. School doesn't really do that,
Okay.
School doesn't actually, in fact, school rewards you, pleasing your teacher. And I guess to some extent in journalism, you have to please your editor. But what, if your editor, is a really, really good editor, what they actually want to see is you being insanely curious about something and then having the ability to translate it, for your readers. But no, it made me a terrible, terrible student because, I write about Howard in there, but I flunked out of Howard. I mean, I had to leave Howard. And a large part of why I left Howard was because I started, practicing journalism professionally when I was 20 years old. And I couldn't believe anybody would pay you to go ask questions you were curious about and then write it down.
It's great.
That's a job that people do. It's incredible. You can have, a career and benefits doing this. I was stunned by this. I wasn't even getting paid that much. But I didn't think anybody would pay me anything. was absolutely incredible. Whereas in school, it was more like, okay, here's what I've said that you should be curious about. Now go figure it out. You know? And so that didn't work as well for me as a young person. And it frustrated the hell out of my parents. I mean, it really, really did. Because I was like a voracious reader as a child. And I would come home, I would fail like 5 out of 7 classes. And they say, what the hell is wrong with you? Like, what is going on with you? Like, how can you come home and do X, Y, and Z and, you know, go to school and, you know, be whatever? But I was, you know. And I actually mark, like, you know, going into journalism is just a huge transition in my life.
Because it gave you a place to focus all of that.
Yes, and it made me know, like, I wasn't weird. Like,
that intense curiosity
that
you had.
And there was a place for that. Like, that was okay. There was a civilized, you know, respectable place where you could put that.
Well, one of the things that you've done, respectable things that you've done for us as a country and in body politic, is to force us to remember things we would prefer to forget.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's one of the through lines in many of your pieces, is I'm going to study this, I'm going to present it to you in a way that will really force you to examine something that may not be in your history books, that may not be in our popular understanding of this. And in your seminal piece, The Case for Reparations, you did just that, in looking at housing policy and the development of housing policy, in asking us to consider whether we should, as a country, look at reparations.
Mm-hmm.
You, at one point, didn't think that was a good idea.
No, I didn't. I was more optimistic then.
I mean, and you changed your mind.
I did. And as a writer, like, I reserve the right to do that. Like, that's one of the cool things.
Before you worked on the piece, or was it the result of
it? Was before.
It was before.
It was before. Yeah. It was before. And what happened? And, you know, it was actually, you know, it was very similar to what I was talking about, you know, today with the police. This happens across the board. You know, whenever anything happens, you know, some sort of, you know, act, and people go back and forth. Was it racist? Was it not? Is it this? Is it that? And, you know, we hem and haw over it. And well, I came to the Atlantic, and one of the cool things about the Atlantic, I really, you know, for the first time in a long time, I had a space to, like, really, really read and absorb mm-hmm. things.
Which is what they ask of their writers.
Yes,
to really,
yeah, they do.
They ask them to occupy
incredible.
An intellectual space.
They do. And so that, after doing that, I felt that the answer was fairly clear, that if you brought the people to this country and you spent, conservatively speaking, 350 years of policy designed to engineer failure and to, you know, design that they be a peon class, that there should be nothing particularly surprising about them existing at the, you know, the lowest level of socioeconomic.
It was interesting platform. That you chose housing, because mm-hmm. at the end of the piece you realize that no matter where you land on the political spectrum, no matter what color your skin happens mm-hmm. to be, no matter where you live, this is the house we all live in.
Yeah.
Because of yeah. these housing policies.
Right.
If you haven't read the article, in short, you focus on a gentleman named Clyde Ross.
Mm-hmm.
And he wants the same thing that almost everyone wants. He wants to raise his children. He worked hard. He mm-hmm. came up from Mississippi. He moved to Chicago. He wanted to own a home, to own a piece of the rock, a piece mm-hmm. of this place we love called America, in his case, a little bit of land in Chicago. Mm-hmm. But he didn't actually own his house
mm-hmm.
because he purchased it on something called contract.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to explain that to us, what that exactly
sure.
means. So he didn't actually have a traditional mortgage.
So in the 30s and 40s, we decided that we wanted to make home ownership accessible to more people in this country. Before then, it wasn't. And part of that was the idea of engineering a broad middle class in this country. When people talk about, like, social engineering and affirmative action with black, I mean, the white middle class in this country is a completely socially engineered act. And home ownership is a deep part of that.
Through FHA loans.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, government loans, you know, loans backed by the government, you know, made home ownership possible for black people. At the very same time we had those programs, we were redlining neighborhoods where, you know, as little as one African-American family could live on a block, and a block could be redlined, which is to say ineligible for any government back loans.
Or a foreigner,
right.
A Negro or a foreigner
right.
in a neighborhood would,
right.
would reduce the overall rating.
And so for Mr. Ross, you know, who had come to Chicago, he had no real ability to get a mortgage. And so what happens when you cut people out of the legitimate lending market? Well, they find the illegitimate market, and in that market was contract loans. And the way contract loans worked was that you put down a down payment, usually some egregious number, on a house that somebody had flipped. You know, maybe they bought it for $7,000 and now they were going to sell it to black people who were effectively a captive market for $15,000. You would have to, you know, put down and make your payments. You know, you would be responsible for the house, but you wouldn't get the actual deed. And in fact, you weren't actually building equity. You didn't get the deed until you had paid the mortgage down, or what was, you know, pitched to you as a mortgage down completely.
And what would happen if you missed a single?
If you missed a single payment, they would throw you out the house. They would keep the down payment, and they would keep all the payments you had made in the meantime. And, of course, they engineered it so that you would be thrown out of the house. That was the point, to get you thrown out of the house. And then they would cycle through another African-American family. They would do it over and over and over and over and over again. In the 50s, I believe 85% of home purchases by African-Americans in Chicago were done this way. You know, while the broad, you know, at the very moment that you're enriching, you know, as you're creating a white middle class, you're plundering black people. You know, that article came out, and I got a call from my mother, and she said that is exactly how your grandmother bought her home. And I didn't even know that, you know, going into it. It's incredible. It's incredible.
And my father was living in Chicago at that time, as all of his brothers were. Mm-hmm. And it's the reason my family landed in Minnesota.
Wow. Did he buy a home in Chicago?
No, he didn't. He saw what was happening and went to Minnesota and was able to use the GI Bill, bought a house from a fellow veteran, and that's the only reason he was. We were the first black family to move into a white neighborhood, but a veteran to veteran, he did that, and you know what happened in our neighborhood. We were the first black family to move in, and every white family that whose property line touched ours moved out because we moved into a neighborhood that was not designed for us. But my father did that.
Were they vocal about it?
Or
did they just silently move out? Like, did they throw things? Did they?
No. They silently. But our house was on a corner, and the people directly next to us couldn't sell their house, and they would put signs in our neighborhood and signs in our yard saying, you know, these people live here, and they didn't use the words these people.
Right.
So people knew if they were buying a house, they were buying a house next to ours.
Good God.
But what you wanted people to do is understand housing policy,
right,
and how things don't happen,
right,
that they're very,
right,
very intentional,
right,
and that in the remembering and that understanding of race in America, that we have to look at the policies that led to,
right,
all of it.
And I think it just spreads to a general, you know, thing. Again, just talking about, you know, going back to the police, like, we think these things happen independent of us, that they're somehow outside of us, you know. And I reject that. You know, I think as a citizen, you have a responsibility, you know, to have, you know, the deepest possible understanding you can have of your country, because it's being done in your name. You know, this was done, you know, in folks' name. And, you know, it's not like that, you know, because, you know, your grandparents who, you know, bought that house because they passed away, you know, the debt is not passed on to you. It is passed on to you because the policy was American. And the society outlives the natural lives of individual citizens. If it didn't, we couldn't have any sort of governance in this country at all. You know, it would effectively mean that, like, you know, anything that you pay taxes for, you know, any act that happened before you were born, you know, you wouldn't have to pay for it. It would destroy governance in and of itself. And so the policies of the government, you know, responsibility does not disappear, you know, because the individual citizens, you know, disappear.
And yet you are one of the more optimistic people I know.
Am I?
You are.
Thank you for saying that.
No, you are. I mean, because
appreciate that.
Well, you know, and people assume he's angry.
I know, they do.
And you're not.
I love my life.
But you do want people to look back with clear eyes.
I do.
In the sense, I know you just told us that you're not religion, but it seems that you believe that there's some redemption in that. That if we understand that.
Yeah, I do. Because I think, like, what you have to do is you have to come to terms with what's possible within your mortal life. And that your job within the, you know, brief period that you have, you know, is to live it, you know, as best you can. And in fact, you know, this is what I say in the book. Do we, you know, at the end of the day, get racism solved in this country? I have no idea. I have no idea. It would not surprise me if we didn't. It would not surprise me if this was with us for the rest of our days. I actually don't think about that as a particularly pessimistic worldview, though, because that's, you know, that may be a fact of the world in and of itself throughout history. Within that, I have then to decide how I am going to live. I have to then, you know, decide what my own moral code within that will be. My responsibility to struggle is not dependent on whether racism will one day be defeated. My responsibility to struggle is dependent, first and foremost, on the people who struggled on my behalf before. That's the first thing. And the second thing is it's dependent on my own individual morality, how I want to live my life. You know, how I, you know, the fact that I want to be able to look at myself in the mirror and say to myself, I was not part of the people who tried to push the earth into the abyss. That's mine. And nothing, you know, can alter that. Nothing about, you know, what happens out in the world can alter that. Even if I, you know, heard that, you know, tomorrow the world was ending, I still, you know, have something within me that says, oh, I'm going to court myself in a certain kind of way. And I'm okay with that. I'm actually fine. I mean, that's what, you know, life is. We're not, you know, immortal. We have to find, you know, our reasons to live and our morality within it.
But you tell your son that his struggle should not be about converting other people, but mm-hmm. our survival depends upon, well, maybe not converting, but coexisting
right.
with mm-hmm. other people.
Right.
Living in peace with other
right.
people. Figuring out how to share this planet and cherish this planet.
Yeah. So this is like one of the conflicts of the book. I recognize that that's true. It's a very hard thing to tell a young person, and I don't know if you feel this. The amount of happiness that you can draw out of your life, the amount, you know, of success that you can, you know, feel like, you know, that you experience in your life will ultimately be dependent on convincing people who have an interest in keeping a foot on your neck. It's hard for me to tell my son that. Like, it's really, really difficult to say that. Maybe I need to say that. I don't know. Maybe that's like, maybe I'm not, you know, going far enough. But I have to have, because I think, like, and this is what I was talking about, you know, with these folks who, you know, we so admire, you know, deeply, who, you know, just for the right to sit at a lunch counter got bashed over the head. And we see that, and we have this kind of ritual where, you know, we have this, you know, solemn, you know, sort of way of, you know, being very, very admiring. I look at that stuff, man, and I get so pissed off. And I feel so, so ashamed. You know, for them, it never should have happened. It hurts me. It burns me that people have to give up some element of their humanity in that sort of way for other people, on their behalf. I don't know that I can quite go there yet. You know, there has to be some part of you that's yours. You know, there has to be something, some way of defining yourself as an individual. Beyond what the dreamers do. You know, it's very, very tough for me to get there. Does that make sense?
It does make sense, but what do you tell him then?
I tell him you have a responsibility to yourself. I tell him you have a responsibility to your ancestors. I tell him you have a great, great responsibility to your grandmother and to your grandfather. I tell him you have a responsibility to the planet. You know, I tell him you have a responsibility to humanity. And that responsibility is to act in the spirit of justice, to act in the spirit of fairness, to be broad-seeing, to be a deeply, deeply humane person. You have a responsibility to tell the truth to people. But if folks are not interested in hearing the truth, you can't, like, yell until you're hoarse. You know, you have to recognize that some people have an interest in not hearing that. And you know, there's some people who are going to hear you, and there's some people who are not going to hear you. And you cannot waste your life. You cannot live your life yelling at people who don't want to hear you.
But do you believe that if you order your steps in the right way, that even the people who don't want to hear you, even the people who turn their back on you, are somehow touched by what you do?
I hope so. I hope so, but I can't order my life around it. That would be a beautiful thing. That would be a beautiful, beautiful thing. It's an interesting thing because I write for a majority white audience, obviously. And when I speak, I'm mostly speaking for majority white audiences. I was up in Wisconsin yesterday at Madison, and someone asked me, they said, do you change? Like, how is your talk different when you're talking to majority, black audience, majority? Do you change how you write? And I said, I will not change anything. I don't change anything. You know, I'm going to make it as pure as I can, and either people, you know, want it or they don't. And I say that to say that I worry about trying to convince people. I worry that will actually influence how I write and how I talk. And I think to the extent that people have respect for how I write, I think it's almost for the fact that I don't actually, like, I just, like Miles Davis, how he turns it back to the crowd. You know, I think, like, people actually get into that, you know? I mean, I know I do. I mean, as an audience member, you know, I don't want things dumbed down to me. Man, you do your thing, and then, you know, I'll get in where I fit in, you know? That's what I want. You know, I'm talking about as somebody, you know, who's receiving it. You know, if I were, you know, here, you know, and I was out in the audience here, and I was at, you know, a lecture, say, on LGBT rights, I want people talking above my level. You know, I don't want them, you know, dumbing down and using language. You know, do you understand, little boy? You know, I know you're just a straight male and you can't quite get this. You know, I want them to talk to me, you know, with all of the fire and all of the passion and all of the rage and all of the love and everything they feel. I want their full humanity, you know, on display. I don't want them contorting themselves. And I guess this is an issue for me because I feel that to some extent we do that as Black people and we kind of lose ourselves. Whenever I go to, you know, a white university, a predominantly white university, to speak, there's always, you know, someone there who asks me and they say, well, what the hell am I supposed to do here? You know, what am I? I'm saying X, Y, and Z, and people don't hear me. And I just, man, that tears me up to hear that. You know, it really tears me up.
But I wonder if they don't hear them or if they're not getting the response. Sometimes for people to hear you, that they don't necessarily have to nod in agreement.
Right. I agree. That's the other
thing. And that is...
Because what they're really saying is I'm not convincing them. I mean, they're not agreeing with me. I mean, that's really, you know, what they're saying. And... I mean, you don't have to agree with me. Like, I'm okay with that. I'm actually all right. I hope I'm making, you know, the clearest possible case, you know, I can. But, you know, I've been wrong before. As
maybe,
you said, you know,
maybe,
I wasn't for reparations.
Maybe that's the best lesson that we could, that we can give our children, mm-hmm. Is that we live in a world where we're not always going to agree.
Yeah.
The world would be actually less interesting
right.
if we all did agree. But that if we can figure out how to raise young people who can be their authentic selves and figure out how to do what we're doing here tonight mm-hmm. is listening to a point of view,
mm-hmm.
another point of view.
Yeah, no, I think that's the best you can expect because the flip side of that is I believe what I believe fervently, but I could be wrong. I just might be wrong. You know, I've been wrong a lot. And so, I mean, you gotta be open to that. You know, maybe I need to be convinced. You know, instead of convincing other people. So.
Well, the one thing we know that we need you to continue doing is to continue writing and to continue to be curious and to continue to be courageous.
Thank you. Thank you.
And to continue to bring us stories that help us remember.
Thank you.
I could talk to you all night, but the clock says we have to
okay.
end
all right.
this evening. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Michelle. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcast at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.